You are listening to Serve, Protect, Lead, a podcast from the International Association of Chiefs of Police, where you will hear from IACP leadership and police leaders across the globe sharing wisdom, insight, and perspective.
Hello, everyone. My name is Christina Fernandez, and I'm a program manager at the IACP. This is our third podcast on the topic of the IACP's Mass Violence Advisory Initiative, a program that provides police leaders with peer-to-peer assistance as they navigate the unique complexities and challenges of a mass violence incident. Our focus today will be on emotional and spiritual healing for first responders and the community following one of these tragedies. We're joined today by two very special guests, Dr. LaMaurice Gardner and Charlie Scoma. Dr. Gardner is a crisis negotiator, tactical officer, and departmental psychologist for various police departments, the Michigan State Police, and several federal law enforcement agencies. Charlie serves as the lead chaplain for the Washington State West Coast Post-Trauma Team and is certified and a member of the Seattle Police Department's Critical Incident Response Team. Welcome to you both. Thank you for taking the time to talk with us today. We have a lot of important material that we want to cover, so let's go ahead and get started. If you wouldn't mind, I'd like each of you to just take a moment. I gave everyone a brief introduction, but you both have so much experience in this area. If you could kind of give us an introduction and tell us what brought you here today. Dr. Gardner, let's start with you.
Okay, well, thank you very much for having me here today. My name is Dr. Lamar Gardner, Lamar for short, for LaMaurice. I'm a clinical and police psychologist. I work as a reserve lieutenant with the Oak County Sheriff's Office, SWAT operator, hostage negotiator. And I'm involved with IACP as a in the Police Psychological Services Section, the National Tactical Officer Association, the Crisis Negotiation Section, and a couple other various identities. My main reason for getting in law enforcement, though, was as a civilian psychologist working with cops, I often got the feedback, well, Doc, you don't understand, only cops can understand cops. So after a couple of officers responded like that, I said, well, what do I need to do to be qualified, bona fide police psychologist that said you need to be a cop. So that's when I went into law enforcement. But my primary reason for going into law enforcement is to serve and protect those who serve and protect. And I've got 27 years in law enforcement, about 34 years as a psychologist. I was attending the mid-year conference for IACP in Orlando, and I ran across some literature about the MVIA, and decided, hey, I'm interested in dealing with the psychological and emotional residuals of mass casualties exposures on officers. So I figured I'd get in touch with you guys and see what I could add to your resources.
And we are so grateful that you did that. Thank you for joining us. Charlie, tell us a bit about your experiences and the path that got you to this point.
Yeah, well, great to be with all of you. Actually, for me, my dad was a long-time volunteer fireman. And at the age of 16, he thought it'd be a good idea if I started volunteering in a rural area. So this idea of service, first responder work, has just been integrated as part of my life since I was a little child. And went into being a pastor. I'm an ordained Presbyterian pastor. Started working in a church here in Seattle, a rather large Presbyterian church that had Seattle police officers there on Sundays. And they approached me about being their chaplain. And it just, for me, that door just swung open in terms of combining what was a little child knowing to serve and this idea of ministry and my ordination. So that was my open door into the Seattle Police Department, where now, as you said, I serve on the West Coast Post-Trauma Team, PTSD Retreat Center for First Responders here in Washington, one of the leaders for that. I'm also an ICPC member, International Conference of Police Chaplains, where I'm the Washington State representative, and I'm the director of a local chaplain academy, training chaplains from all over the region, and actually all over the world. We've had many people attend our week-long chaplain academy here in terms of training. And then, you know, from that, what leads me directly into the mass violence initiative is former Chief Best had recommended me to the group, and we had a series of conversations around that. I just come from a place of healing, of seeing the trauma, the effects of it. As a chaplain now, I do a lot of memorial services for our retirees, and many of them aren't getting their full retirement. They're dying at early ages. And that just saddens me to know that they've given so much to our communities and then the quality of life after that, that they don't get to enjoy. So a big part of what I am about here is that emotional healing and trying to just do my best to provide some form of support so that they have a long career and get every bit of their retirement.
Thank you. I think it's very clear that for both of you, what you do is very personal to you and is very meaningful to you. And the value that you bring to our group is just very, very personal to us as well, because, you know, I'm going to talk about the Mass Violence Advisory Initiative right now for our listeners who are not familiar. The MVAI provides peer-to-peer assistance to police leaders facing a mass violence incident. And what makes the program unique is that our SMEs, like Charlie and Dr. Gardner, represent a variety of different disciplines. We have chiefs, sheriffs, public information officers, mental health professionals, chaplains, investigators, but they all share that they've experienced a mass violence incident firsthand, and they understand the complexities and challenges in a way that I think if you haven't, it's very difficult to understand. So they're in a unique position to provide police leaders help in a way that no one else can unless they've really lived it and experienced it. And as we talked about, Charlie and Dr. Gardner have such deep personal feelings about their work, and healing is such a in the forefront of the work that they want to do. So very, very valuable for us, and I'm grateful to have them here today. We're going to talk a little bit about mass violence incidents. Dr. Gardner, can you kind of talk about the initial role of a psychologist at the scene of a mass violence incident? How can you help? What is it that psychologists can do in those situations?
Well, I've been preparing for that type of incident, both tactically and psychologically for many years, going back to when they first started doing the North American Active Assailants Conferences. I've attended three of those over the years, and basically they provide a tactical debriefing of the of national and international mass shootings. And I had been putting together for a long time some type of protocol. I've been teaching disaster clinicians how to respond to natural disasters. But with regard to clinicians first and chaplains first responding to these situations, I was a first responder last year at the Oxford High School mass shooting where four students were killed and seven were injured. I was a first responder as a SWAT operator. My immediate role as a SWAT operator was to clear the building, look for other threats, and evacuate children and teachers from the classrooms. But once I completed my role, it switched to police psychologists. And my captain and my lieutenant had me begin doing diffusings with the initial responders, the first persons in the door, as well as the teachers and administrators who were hands-on with some of the wounded and injured dead students. Several of the first responders and teachers were still covered with children's blood on them and were in a state of shock and emotional upheaval. I had another colleague, another police psychologist I contacted from the scene and had her go to the reunification site where students and the parents were reuniting. And she was there even for the unfortunate death notifications. When I finally left that school, I got in my car and I was bawling. Images I couldn't get out of my head, particularly of the two little girls laying in the hallway, dead in puddles of blood. I immediately called my mentor, Dr. Phil Trompeter, and began processing my thoughts and emotions that I was experiencing. But basically what we do when we get to the scene in a clinical role is diffusing and trying to get people back grounded, providing encouragement and support, allowing people to vent. And I want to say people, the first responders, as well as family members or administrations, teachers, et cetera, and normalizing the psychological, emotional, and behavioral reactions. There's no normal way to experience this. And we're emotional beings. So allowing people to do just what our biology suggests to do and not pathologizing that, and maybe encourage them that it's okay to cry. It's okay to be upset right now. These are overwhelming experiences that we're not used to.
It's so important that you say that. We're going to touch upon that a little bit later, because you were aware that you were experiencing something and that you needed help. And so for us, part of this conversation is going to focus on how do we get law enforcement to make that same realization and reach out when they need it. Mm-hmm. Charlie, I'm going to ask you the same question. What role does a chaplain take on in a scene of a mass violence incident? How can they assist?
Yeah, it's a great question. There's a lot of ways to maybe look at this, but I think first and foremost, and we teach a class on what we call a ministry of presence, and it's, you know, having a calm presence to the best of our ability to be there and assure, you know, commanders and stuff that we're there to provide that support. And again, that maybe that calm presence to work with families, to work with what's a very chaotic scene in the moment. People have a lot of questions, a lot of anger, a lot of emotion. And, you know, as a chaplain, how can we enter that again and provide a good listening ear, provide hope maybe? And it may not seem like there's a lot of hope, but even if it's just a sliver of light that you're not alone, that I'm going to be here with you through this moment, through whatever that means in the timeline of things to come, in that. I think the other thing that, you know, is that I think we need to realize is in these events of mass violence, what I realized in mine was I can't do this on my own. I need other chaplains. I need others that are going to be present. So there almost becomes, in my role here, particularly with Seattle right now, where I would be more of a coordinator than I am a chaplain. And that's very different for chaplains. They, you know, we are trained to be present, to be there at the scene, to do all that work. But you really sometimes have to pull back and take a bigger picture of what's going on here. You know, you go to, for us, the duck boat accident for where we have 50 casualties and 4 dead. You know, one chaplain can't handle all that work. And these are international students and diplomats and working with our emergency operations center. So I think my best response to that would be just to say that for that command, IC incident commander to know that they've got someone in a spiritual, if you will, a spiritual role that can play some of that, take some of that responsibility, and they can be assured it's going to get done well, that we're going to offer the best care that we can. We're going to offer what we can as a resource. And it's one more thing they don't have to worry about in a very chaotic operational scene that they've got a lot to do in that moment. I often find there's not a lot of words. I don't have a lot of answers in the moment, right? People are angry, upset, and that. So how can, again, chaplains sit in that mystery and the unknown and be okay with that? How can it just be that we're just present relationally, and I'm a person here that will sit with you and we'll work through all this emotion in the moment, and just be a conduit too, potentially from the PIO on scene to the families. Like, how can I help bridge some of that gap too and get good information? As we know, there's a lot of misinformation that gets put out there really quick and people will fill in the gaps. So how can I help bring the right information and not cause any further harm than is already present? I think it's my bet, you know, in the moment, it's really a ministry of presence and it's being there and trying to provide, again, that support as needed.
That's really valuable. I hear the phrase a lot, it's okay to not be okay. And I feel mm-hmm. like a little bit of what you're sort of getting at, that you kind of stand with them in that moment and say, it's all right to experiencing what you're feeling. That is quite normal.
Yeah. Chris, it's amazing to me still how many people don't give themselves permission to be angry. From a faith perspective, they think God or whatever their belief system is will be so upset. And I have to give them permission. I'm angry. It's okay. You know, read the Psalms. They're full of all the emotions. So, you're right. It's okay not to be okay. And in the moment for sure.
Absolutely. So we know law enforcement is very well trained on handling critical incidents. They know what to do. They have the experience. Dr. Gardner, how does a mass violence incident differ from maybe other kinds of tragedies or other kinds of situations that they deal with? Like, what are the unique needs that they have following a mass violence incident versus another type of critical incident?
So let me talk about the way that incident is input into that officer's psyche, soul, and being. Once in a while out on the street, look at it like you're getting hit by a snowball in the face, okay? That's the periodic things, the tragedies that happen in law enforcement. But this mass casualty situations, mass shootings, those are like an avalanche of stress and problems coming at you. And, you know, not trying to be too funny, but size matters when it comes down to it. You know, that single snowball or that avalanche coming to you. Mass violence incidents can cause sensory and emotional overload. The scenes are horrific and have the potential for creating permanent haunting memories by way of nightmares, flashbacks, and intrusive thoughts. And these sensory memories need to be processed and integrated. When we talk about the routes of sensory input, the more routes that are affected, the deeper the root of the memory. So take, for example, you know, hearing the gunshots, hearing the screams of the children for help, agonal breathing of somebody who's dying, or that sucking chest wound. That's the hearing part. Seeing it, the visions, seeing wounded victims, pools of blood, dead victims, muzzle flashes, things in disarray or abandoned classrooms and hallways. The smell of gunpowder, the steely smell of blood, the smell even of burning flesh, as I've heard from some of my officers and from other critical incidents. In a mass casualty situation, once the scene is secure, touch, you're going hands-on providing first aid and CPR, carrying out wounded individuals, applying tourniquets or bandages. And in those rare occasions, even taste, the taste of the blood in the air, or if you're giving mouth to mouth, I've had first responders with the same taste of the victim's blood in their mouth. So we've got all of these sensory perceptual systems bringing in this information. Again, the more involved, the deeper the wound or the deeper the injury for the first responders. Also, mass violence brings the questions of how and why to the forefront, creates a sense of vulnerability for ourselves, for our families, our kids, paranoia, and not a psychotic paranoia, but worry and concern about what might happen, the what ifs, and grief. And literally, we try to make sense out of the insanity of what happened as we try and reestablish balance. And I've been a psychologist 34 years. I can't make sense out of the insanity of some human behavior. But we can get stuck in this second guessing our actions or the actions of others. And that can be problematic.
Charlie, I'm going to ask you the same question, but perhaps from the community perspective. How does a mass violence incident impact the community in a way that other types of tragedies don't? How are they different?
Yeah. From a community perspective, right? I mean, there's very probably few mass casualties when this kind of event happens that doesn't touch everybody in the community of some sort. And I think that's really the difference, right? I can go day to day to some of the other, if you will, singular kind of calls I go to and nobody will ever know about it. But in mass violence situations, the community almost entirely knows what has happened, whether it be because of news coverage, whether it be because they know somebody that's involved. And it doesn't matter whether, again, rural town, a big city, people know about it. And then again, this inquisitive sense of we got to know or we want to help. And suddenly you're flooded with all sorts of people from the community trying to come to the scene or trying to get somewhere. And like I said, either to provide help, to get information, to be supportive of family, friends, whoever they know there. So as the doctor was saying, it's a much larger scale. It's suddenly this huge, right, event that is galvanized the community or brought us together in some way that we now have a span of control issue in what we're going to do. I think people have heard me say that, you know, as a community, you know, how do we then again in the long term look at healing? And it involves a whole community, like in that sense, when we get there. But I just think how it affects it, and all the questions come up, the why, could we have prevented it? What's not in place? You know, even from a law enforcement standpoint, you know, when we see these things, we begin to be reflective of what didn't we have in place to stop it? Because it is so painful, so hurtful, and so emotional. And the community does the same thing. They try to figure things out. And it breaks, from my standpoint, it brings up a lot of our brokenness and a lot of our hurt, not just in the event itself, but in other areas as well, where we suddenly see, in a sense, how fractured we are and the work that we need to do to come back together and to be unified or seek some kind of unity and peace together in that. So yes, the community grieves just as much. And it's just, again, much larger scale, louder, the unknown, the questioning, it comes from all sorts of directions. The community is in a lot of pain.
So as we kind of move now towards the recovery part of the conversation, what kinds of issues do officers and the community deal with in the long term following one of these incidents? And Charlie, since you're kind of already on that topic, if you would kind of talk about that a little bit, what kind of long term issues do we see?
Yeah, I think some of the, you know, and we've talked about this a little bit, but there's, with these events, right, in any kind of grief, there's a timeline. And I tell people, you're on the road to grief, you know, whether it be from my father passing very expectedly, but I still remember him every year on that date and things. So, you know, the timeline is going to be forever in some sense. And what we do now to begin to heal and process some of that is the work we do ahead. So I think the challenge that I've often seen with law enforcement is they don't get included in some of those, if you will, the community rituals, the memorials, the reclaiming, the prayer vigils, the candlelight vigils, the gatherings. And that brings to me an extra level of pain for our law enforcement officers, honestly, that they also were there and felt the effects of that and need some closure or some form of processing as well in their healing process. So I think as we plan these kind of, if you will, events going forward, memorials or prayer vigils, I think it's really important we try to build that relationship with our law enforcement and firefighting community, to be honest, any of the first responders there, to be a part of those in some ways. And it doesn't mean they have to speak. It doesn't mean they have to have a role. They can show up out of uniform, but they need a place to also feel like they're there as well and included in that work going forward. And your timeline is as long as you need it to be, right? And I think I heard on one of our podcasts from the families, you know, families don't like to call it an anniversary, right? Because that seems a little more happy and hopeful, you know, and I don't know what the right word is, but yeah, what are going to be the significant markers going forward? Do we call them remembrance? Do we call it a tragedy? What do we call it? But every year, right, we'll tend to gather and remember. So how are we, again, involved in some of that long-term process? How are we involved in long-term psychological care and healing? How do we reclaim a place of violence to be a place of sacredness now? And acknowledge the story, don't forget it, but reclaim it for good so that it doesn't become this stigma that every time I go by that location, this is the only thing I remember now. I remember the tragedy there. And it takes time. So I'm not saying this is going to happen within weeks, days, months, years. It takes time to build those things in place and get to that place of healing. But we definitely have a timeline that we need to begin to create and look at of how we are going to begin to do some things in the healing process.
So much good information there, so much to think about. Dr. Gardner, you said something once to me that I always think about, that psychological injury takes longer than physical injury to heal. And that always stays with me. Why is that? Can you elaborate on that?
Well, I'll do it by example. So if I cut myself shaving, it'll stop bleeding about a half a minute. If I catch a cold, it'll go away in about a week. If I break a bone, it's going to be 6 to 8 weeks to heal. We know that biologically. But if I sustain a psychological or emotional injury, it could take weeks, months, or even years to heal, especially if we don't seek treatment. I know that when I do my debriefings, my formal debriefings, I'm letting people know and normalizing some of the things they're going to experience. And in the midst of the critical incident, as it's happening, muscle tremors, nausea, hyperventilation, sweating, perceptual distortions, like auditory exclusion, slow motion time, et cetera, within minutes to hours, shock, fear, denial, anger, emotional numbing, feelings of unreality, within days to weeks, grief, intrusive thoughts about the incident, flashbacks, nightmares, or other sleep disturbances. Mood-wise, depression, emotional withdrawal, anxiety, guilt, paranoia, even physical dysfunctions like gastrointestinal problems, stress, diarrhea, etc. When they know that these are going to be present, they're not going to think they're crazy or weak. You know, it's when they become lasting months to years where we have the anger, hostility, irritability, problems with authority, chronic fatigue, poor concentration, loss of confidence, and drug or alcohol abuse, that's when it becomes problematic. But unfortunately, help in this profession of first responders, of gladiators, HELP is one of those dirty, nasty four-letter words in the law enforcement profession. They're often told, you know, suck it up, buttercup, or you don't need a shrink, you need a drink. I've seen in many of the rituals we go through in law enforcement after a terrible loss, the alcohol is involved. And I get it's part of the culture, but it's not the only and the most helpful of the tools we use to manage stress. In reality, therapy helps, medications help, but the longer we wait to address the problem, the worse the injury gets. We can't escape our memories. We have to work through them so the ghost of the trauma don't haunt you. And one of my patients once told me, you know, doc, we chase monsters, but we fear ghosts. Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman in his class, Bulletproof Mind, says this. He says, you're as sick as your secrets. So again, going back to the longer we await or the longer we avoid addressing the problem, the worse the problem becomes for us. And with the potential of developing into post-traumatic stress disorder, which is sort of my area of expertise. And I get a lot of officers who are hesitant to seek help until they realize it really works and they have the courage. And I emphasize, it takes courage to reach out and say, I need some help, I've got a problem. That goes against the cop culture, but we need to change the culture.
So Charlie, Dr. Gardner gave us some things to kind of keep an eye out for, to know that our officers are struggling. Would you, do you have anything that you would add to that? And how do we gauge how the community is doing and how are they healing following an incident like this? What kind of signs do we see there?
Yeah, you know, he's absolutely right, right? And I was thinking about kind of what we might talk about today, but you know, it comes back to this. It always comes back to relationships, right? It's always, it's the preemptive stuff. How am I connected to my community? How am I building relationships? How am I in tune with the good days and the bad days? Like, how am I having a sense of what is happening, you know, on a day-to-day basis or, you know, over time? And I think that's one of the keys is, you know, how are we building those relationships with faith-based leaders or community leaders and in our schools and et cetera to know how are we doing as a community right now? You know, it's pretty well known how our struggles in Seattle are right now on a whole. And so we're in a very fragile place, if you will. So if the incident happened today, I'd expect a lot of anger, a lot of emotion, a lot of tiredness, a lot of low morale, you know, those kinds of things, because I'm making the rounds and I'm listening on a day-to-day basis to know and kind of gauge where we're at. And I think the community goes through those same things. So where is it that I, again, am building those relationships beforehand? And I think once you have those relationships also built within the department, then you kind of have a sense when you go to a roll call and you get a sense of, oh, something's different today. Right? What is it that's different? Why is the mood the way it is? And how do I work with sergeants or lieutenants or whoever's in, you know, responsible in that place just to kind of check in? And it doesn't have to be anything real formal. It's just, hey, how are you going? I had a sense of that things, you know, didn't feel so good today. What's been happening? And that can be from day-to-day incidents and not just a mass event where it's just kind of been one day after another, shift after a shift, and it finally kind of built up into this sense that we're just struggling, we're tired, and we're emotionally exhausted right now. So I think we can see that. You know, the other thing I want to really highlight, because I had this conversation a couple weeks ago, is we can't forget also our chief officers and our commanders in these situations that have to deal with a much, in a sense, a different level of stress, if you will, from the political atmosphere, from the community, from outcries, from answering, from, you know, all of their work as well. So from a chaplain, you know, for me being a neutral place, I have built those relationships where chiefs feel like they can come and talk to me and we can meet and have that safe environment and do that. And I don't want us to forget that work as well, that those, that command staff has a, you know, a lot going on as well. And they may not feel like they can be in the room with all the officers, or they might feel like they can, and we can't forget to invite them and process also with what they may be dealing with from a much bigger level too, in that. So I think it still just comes back to, how do we know our community? How are we paying attention before the event happens so that we know to the best of our ability when the event happens, what we can kind of expect, and also be flexible to know who knows what to expect. I have no idea, right? I have no idea how people are going to react and need to be prepared for that. And so I expect whatever comes with that.
So my next question is really going to be about how do we get our police leaders and our officers to open up and admit that they need help, which we know is a word that they don't gravitate towards. So, and I think, Charlie, I think you laid out that foundation really well that, you know, over time you build up relationships with them so that when something like this happens, they already feel comfortable talking to you and they already feel that they're not going to be judged and that they can be open about it. Dr. Gardner, what are some ways that you are able to get officers to kind of open up and to Charlie's point, not just officers, but to command staff and police leaders, how do we get them to feel like it's okay to talk about what they're experiencing?
Well, one of the first things I did after realizing cops tend to only trust cop was become one. And that familiarization helps officers to feel comfortable, particularly with me as a psychologist. And I brought 3 to 4 other doctoral level psychologists on board, put them through the Reserve Academy. So now they have the qualifications, the training, and they're in a uniform out there on the streets working side by side with the deputies. But what also helps is the in-service training, the wellness training. I've got a cop shock police stress class, surviving the emotional repercussions of law enforcement activity I put on. And every time I put on that class, maybe twice a year, I get 3 or 4 of the participants, the police officers, who approach me and say, hey, I want to set up an appointment. Okay. So, and then what helps mostly too in that class is I always bring in my former patients as guest speakers in that class to talk about their story of their trauma, their treatment, their recovery, and their reintegration back to full functioning in law enforcement. What's critical is to let officers know and first responders know that they're not crazy or weak if they start to present with symptoms of stress or PTSD. And it takes strength, as I mentioned earlier, and courage to seek help. I need them to reassess their perceptions of what clinical resources and chaplain services are, to rethink. If cognize, the word cognize means to think, then recognize or recognize is to rethink. We're rethinking the culture. We're rethinking what it means to seek help. And ultimately, we know that pain divided is much easier to tolerate than pain in isolation. We've got about 150 officers per year who commit suicide. And I guarantee you the majority of them are ones who are afraid to reach out and ask for help. We've got about 55 officers killed feloniously per year. We've got about 45 officers killed in motor vehicle accidents per year. But 3 times as many who are killed feloniously are killing themselves. Last year was the most fatal year for law enforcement in my history because of COVID, and there were, I think, 232 deaths COVID related, adding to all the rest of these. So it's been a bad year, bad time for law enforcement, but we have resources. And if we take advantage of those resources, if departments will start integrating clinicians, not just clinicians, peer support. I started peer support programs with Detroit. I've been integral in training peer support. I respond with our peer support personnel. We have a chaplain's corps with the sheriff department, with Detroit Police Department, most of those smaller departments in and around Oakland County and Wayne County. So we're getting there, but we're not getting there fast enough. We're reaching out, but the word's not getting out strong enough, okay? I have just this year, we had our first wellness training with the sheriff department. Now, I've done separate wellness training for smaller groups, but this was the whole for the sheriff department. Detroit has their 40-hour training. We're trying to push wellness training in there. I've done some smaller group meetings, but not for the whole of DPD. But we're getting there. The word's getting out.
Yeah. You know, I'd add to that, too, that, Chris, even in this idea of reaching out for help or wellness now, like we have a wellness unit now in SPD that I helped form. We're about 3 years in. And we're trying to change culture. Well, that's going to take a decade, right? So we got to start planting seeds now and how they're watered and how it grows. My hope would be when I, retire or leave here, I've left that in a better place and that foundation to where now it is just integrated in. So I think we also have to remember that we're trying to change something that, you know, it's going to take a while, and we just have to keep after it and be resilient in it and believe in it, right? And see it through. For me, even with our command staff now, I get invited to at least a quarterly meeting. So I get to sit in with the chiefs for, you know, not all their meetings, but enough to check in. On a lot more lighthearted note, I play golf with them. I do my hobbies with them to just get to know people, right? And I think that, again, we can't underestimate the idea of building relationships and getting that trust built, so that when these things happen, they will see us as a resource and know that they can trust that.
So critical.
When I teach or I'm doing these presentations, I have a pop bottle with me, and I'll take the pop bottle and I'll shake it up. I'll agitate it, just like we get shaken up or agitated with some of the things we're exposed to. Or I'll take that plastic pop bottle and drop it on the ground and it'll solidly smack the ground. And I ask the audience, I say, what builds up in this pop bottle when I shake it? And they say pressure. And I say, if the pressure's not addressed, what could happen? They say it'll explode. I'm like, yeah, exactly, it'll explode. That shaking up over time, okay, is a corrosive effect. Or when I drop that bottle on the ground, it's a toxic effect. And when I hand that bottle to one of my officers, they do something with it. They might take that bottle and push it over here. I say, great, take it away from the source of agitation. Then I'll take the bottle and give it to somebody else. And they'll say, well, you know, I guess I'll open it and I'll show me. So they slowly take it by the lid and release the pressure. I said, where did the pressure come out of? The top of the bottle, the lid of the bottle. No, the mouth of the bottle. Okay, we're releasing the pressure through the mouth of the bottle, just the same way in therapy or in counseling, the officer, the person who's going through this stress and trauma has built up this pressure, releases it and talks it out. But the unfortunate thing is, you know, cops by history will take the top of that bottle and crank it down tighter and tighter, or they'll take the lid off and pour in the Jack Daniels, the Bacardi, or whatever the drink of choice has been. And I say, you can't do that. That doesn't work. It never has worked. So, but holding in that stress, that's the destructive thing. There was a study comparing the life expectancy of Detroit police officers to the life expectancy of other Detroit city workers. They found there was a 7-year difference in life expectancies, with the Detroit police officers dying 7 years sooner than their city worker counterparts. And that same research has been replicated on different scales throughout the country. We know that if we don't address the stress, you know, on a physical level, we've already talked about the psychological and emotional level, but on a physical level, hypertension, gastrointestinal problems, cancer, et cetera, even alcoholism, you know, and again, that's part of the culture. I can't remember this work at site the study was, but about 10% civilians have alcoholism problems, but about 25% in law enforcement. Okay, again, we're using the wrong tools to try and cope.
Right. So as we kind of close out today, you both brought me to my last two questions that I think are really what I want our listeners to have some takeaways from all of this, because you provided them with such good information. So what can command staff do to some takeaways for them to foster an environment where following a mass violence incident or a tragedy of some nature like that, where their personnel feel like they can get the support they need and they can talk openly? What can they put in place to make that a reality for them following one of these incidents?
The one thing I really appreciate about not just my sheriff, but different chiefs I've seen on the news and the media, they don't allow people to pass judgment too soon. As Charlie was saying earlier, misinformation from the media reports or lawsuits have been known to re-traumatize individuals involved. We need to accept that those first thoughts are emotionally driven and they're often incorrect. We can't take what the media says as the gospel truth or accurate. It takes time to gather up all this information and to importantly process the events that are leading up to and involving the incidents from start to finish. So accurate and complete information is critical for correcting the thought distortions and filling in the blanks. Command providing support, empathy, and recognition of the efforts of their officers. Reinforcing to them as well, I'm glad you're alive. I'm glad you were there to help out, to make a difference. Deter or just try to get officers not to second guess themselves. Sometimes, you know, command or other officers who might say, well, I would have done that, or I would have done, you know, this. And in the milliseconds you have in the midst of a critical incident, you don't have the time to process all that and look at all your options. In the Colosseum's ring, there's no time to think of these things. That blood is slippery and the lions have their own ideas. You know, gladiators often, after the battle, are no match for the numbers, words, or rhetoric they might get from the media, from administration, or even from the attorneys. Having qualified mental health professionals and chaplains on speed dial for those command personnel to call as things are unfolding, and those departments to seek out clinicians specifically trained in police psychologists. I've encouraged my office, my psychologists, to get out from behind their desk and go along on ride-alongs, or even go through police reserve academies. I've had several chaplains come through my academy and be reservists. Mm-hmm. The one thing that I also emphasize is read and apply the information that we've attached as a resource, preparing for the unimaginable, how chiefs can safeguard officers' mental health before and after mass casualty events. That was a document put out in about 2016. Give recognition by way of ribbons, medals, and ceremonies for all involved. For a long time, we overlooked even our dispatchers, and they're an integral part of mass casualty situations. Mm-hmm. Putting things in perspective in the aftermath. My sheriff, Sheriff Bouchard, said an amazing thing at the end of each of my debriefings. My first critical incident debriefing was about 160 people. I'm sorry, 110 people. My second was about 60 people. My third was about 40 people. This was after the mass shooting at Oxford High School. And Sheriff Bouchard put things in perspective because people were upset about the number of people who were killed and injured, et cetera. And Sheriff Bouchard said, there were 18 unspent rounds on that suspect. That was 18 more potential victims. You, our deputies that were at the debriefing, he said, you stopped this from happening. You saved 18 lives. And when he said that, I saw a rush of health come among these officers, of satisfaction. Some of the pain was washed away, reinforcing that it takes a lot of courage to engage when you're under fire. My challenge coin on the front of it says courage under fire. On the top of it, on the bottom of it, says courage after fire. That's the courage to reach out, to say I need some help, to attend a debriefing, to reach out to your chaplains, your peer support, or your mental health professionals.
That's incredible. That's a lot of those are really actionable things that they can think about. Charlie, what would you say? How can command staff better foster an environment where law enforcement can kind of get the help they need and not be afraid to ask for it?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things, right? Again, recognize, and I think more and more are that, you know, right, you need a peer support team. If you don't have one, work at putting one in place, even if it's one or two officers that you begin to be dedicated to that work. Most do. Look at wellness as a big picture. Have that in place. I would, you know, the real practical is emotional debriefings need to come before tactical debriefings. So I think acknowledging that, right, we'll get to the tactical stuff in time. I mean, every officer is probably already running through that, every supervisor, what went on, but we need to acknowledge the emotional debriefing needs to happen before the tactical debriefings. And, you know, and that may look different for everybody. I'll give you one example. After all the protests here in Seattle and things that settled down, we got command staff to allow every watch to be held over for 1 hour of overtime to debrief with us. And kept and made a concerted effort to make sure that every squad had a chance to debrief with us. Over about a month period of time, we went around and met, and the command staff, as I said, gave them an hour in overtime to stay, and the shift before to stay over and cover calls so we could do that work. That seems small, but that's a big thing. That's acknowledging it. I would also say that command staff has to be aware it's not a check the box. You don't do it just one time and say, well, we did that. You got to stay after it and you got to acknowledge it. Like I said, we've talked about a timeline here. This could be a year, years in the making. I've had officers 6 months from an incident have a smell suddenly and be triggered and called me up for a ride along, right? We just have to stay engaged with that process and see how our people are doing and put things in place that allow them the healing they need, right? And continue to trust our process of checking in there. Acknowledge the pain, be upfront with that. Don't, you know, we're all grieving, we're all in this. This isn't a time to be stronger and better necessarily. This is a time to acknowledge pain and sadness and let that happen. That's a good, those are good emotions to be feeling and to let out and be encouraged to with no, in a sense, repercussions. And I just think, and command staff showing up. You know, show up at those first roll calls, show up at those first after the event meetings and just be present. You might not even have anything to say as a command staff, but you're there. So they know that you care, that you're part of that team and you're showing that you are invested in them and acknowledging. And I think everything the doctor said, there's medals, hope, the goodness, you know, a lot of negativity obviously comes out of these and some of it rightfully so. But how can we highlight the good work that was done as well? And acknowledge that I think is really important. And then again, just be educated about the signs of PTSD and all the things we've listed today so that again, we can better care for our people.
So my last question is somewhat related, but a slightly different take on it. How can our officers help each other heal? Not just necessarily in the peer support way, but just in the day-to-day. Dr. Gardner talked about, you know, some of the responses that officers that are involved in one of these incidents get from another officer, and that doesn't necessarily lead towards healing. How can officers help each other? Charlie, let's start with you with that.
Yeah. I sometimes laugh and I'm chuckling a little bit because I tell people we wouldn't need peer support if we knew how to talk to one another, right? If I knew that my squad mate saw something in me and could come freely to ask me about how I'm doing and not face any kind of repercussion or anything out of that. Just a genuine sense of, I care about you. We've worked together. I see something's going on, right? And that they could ask and I could respect that and go, oh, that might be, you know, that sign. And so we have to create that kind of a culture as well. See something, say something. And that doesn't mean, again, that you're less than, you're unfit, that we need to go to our supervisor, right? We need to trust that we know each other and we care about each other. And so we have to foster those kind of environments. We've also created systems with some of our like apps where now officers have everything on their work phones to be able to get a hold of a peer support member, a psychologist, a chaplain, you know, any kind of counseling they need are all in an app and at their disposal as well to say that they can check in. If they know they need something, they can go there. But I just think we need to encourage our officers to, again, be able to have that freedom to check in. They're united now by this unfortunate event. They have it in common. So how, again, can we provide space for that and acknowledge that and not have to worry about what the other feels? No judgment, nothing that way. It's, you know, as he said, like, talk about it. Get that apple out of your throat and let that pressure out through the mouth. You're right. And just really, I believe in that. I just chuckle because I think we've just lost that ability, right? Just the common sense to love our neighbor. Well, how many of us really know our neighbors, right? It would stave off a lot of our issues, I think, if we could just get to a place of acknowledging the other human and the humanity that we all are.
Talking about emotions has unfortunately been so taboo in the culture of law enforcement. And you know, when officers start talking about, you know, we're these macho, heroic, you know, RoboCop kind of guys, at least we try and believe that. But the reality is we're human beings. And when we talk about our emotions, people are afraid that it's going to lead to being labeled a mental, being put on rubber gun duty, especially if you talk about depression or suicidality. Ruin your chances for promotion and all the other things that keep people from moving forward and getting the help they need. We need to change of culture. We need to get people feeling comfortable. We need support from the upper command that, no, everything you talk about is confidential. Mm-hmm. And I have my chiefs and some of my sheriffs who have disclosed to their personnel that they've been in therapy before. Okay. Mm-hmm. And when the leadership says it's okay, then the officers might feel a lot more comfortable. When I've had officers who have been going through some difficulties, they won't make an appointment, but they'll call me, as Charlie might also attest, they'll call me and ask me to do a ride along with them. And next thing you know, I'm doing an 8-hour therapy session, which is something they needed, but they couldn't out say, I need help. Okay. So again, we're chipping at it. We're changing the culture. We're getting people more comfortable. Fellow officers have to be able to say it's okay to talk to somebody. I've had many an officer who see me refer some of their colleagues to me. Okay. And word starts getting around, this is okay to talk about. But, you know, we have to get off the idea that, you know, I can roll back up for you on a critical incident, but can I roll back up on you when the incident's your own psychological and emotional welfare and health? And there's the challenge, because that's the duality of our role, to be our brother or our sister's keeper on two levels. There's psychological and emotional well-being and their physical well-being. Mm.
Such good points. Thank you both so much for taking the time today to share your insights with our listeners. The importance of the healing process, spiritually, psychologically, following tragedies like the ones we talked about, cannot be highlighted enough. And you all brought so much information about that. It's so critical. Thank you for everything that you do for the agencies and communities that you work with, and for your participation and for supporting the Mass Violence Advisory Initiative. We appreciate you so much. To our listeners, if you would like to learn more about the Mass Violence Advisory Initiative, please visit our webpage at www.theiacp.org/MVAI. This concludes our podcast today. Be well.